supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has struck down the state's congressional map. In the decision, the court found the map violates the state constitution and discriminates against Democrats. As a result, the map will not be used in the upcoming May primary. Joining me now to talk about the ruling and what it means going forward, WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies and Katie Meyer from Harrisburg. Katie, let's start out with you. Can you explain to us exactly what happened?
Sure. So this was a very short-term decision by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. They issued an order, but not a full opinion with more information and more guidance for the legislature. So there's been some uncertainty with what they're supposed to do now. But the gist of it is that in a 4-3 decision, they ruled that the maps, as you said, are unconstitutional. That means they have to have a new map in place by February 19th, and that's going to be, as you said, for use in the primary election, which is on May 15th. Now, this basically means that legislators, they're being, you know, given the opportunity to redraw these maps, they kind of have to do it from scratch. It will be handled like a regular bill. It'll have to go through the House and the Senate on all these different considerations and then be approved by the governor. And that, again, has to happen before February 19th. Now, if the legislature does not do this in the given time frame, this order says then the Supreme Court will redraw the map. That would be unprecedented. And now I should say, the Senate has already confirmed that they're going to be seeking a stay from the U.S. Supreme Court so that they do not have to follow this order. We're going to start seeing a lot of action very quickly.
Katie, quickly is a unique term when it comes to Harrisburg.
Yeah.
How likely is it that they could redraw these maps virtually overnight in state legislature terms?
I've been talking to a lot of people who say, listen, we'll do it if we have to. But it doesn't seem like it's going to be something that they can do easily. And I hesitate to say it's impossible, but you know, you just said it, they don't work quickly. And this is a very complicated thing. I mean, it took about a year for us to redraw the maps 10 years ago. So, I mean, it's not a quick process.
I'll just throw in here, this is Dave Davies, that, you know, there's much more sophisticated computerized mapping technology now. So technically, you can do a lot more quickly than you used to. But every line is going to be a political battle, and that's what will get tricky.
And Dave, while all this was happening, we've seen some surprising developments in what's widely regarded as the most gerrymandered district in Pennsylvania, the 7th district in the western suburbs of Philadelphia. What's going on?
Well, Tom, this district is held by Republican Pat Meehan. He is a formidable 4-term incumbent, and the Democrats were counting on trying to take him out, but it wasn't going to be easy. Then, over the weekend, the New York Times reported that Meehan had settled a sexual harassment complaint by a female staffer several decades under. According to the Times, he professed romantic interest in her. She rebuffed. He got angry. She filed the complaint, and there was a financial settlement. Now, so far, Republican leaders haven't abandoned Pat Meehan, but he's been taken off the Ethics Committee. There will be an investigation, and it's fair to say this is not the kind of thing anybody wants to take into a reelection campaign. So we don't know whether he'll be on the ballot or a wounded candidate on the ballot at this point.
Do the Democrats have a strong candidate to take on Meehan or his replacement if he doesn't run?
There were 5 declared candidates, Tom, but the strongest, State Senator Dalen Leach, was wounded last month by accusations of sexual misconduct of his own. So I think most people think he won't be a viable candidate. They were looking for someone stronger to run against Meehan than the 4 that they had. And sure enough, last Thursday, another candidate filed registration papers. Her name is Shelley Chauncey. She's a 37-year-old mother of 3, a 15-year veteran of the CIA. The party hopes she'll have the right kind of profile to run effectively against Meehan or whatever Republican they face.
So what does this mean for the suddenly changing race if its boundaries change over the next month?
Wow, it's going to be wild, isn't it? Well, what it means is that for this district and every district, every challenger and every incumbent will look at the new map and can file to run in any district they choose. And some will find that they now live outside the district they thought they were going to run in and maybe in different districts. So it'll be a confusing situation.
Katie, final thoughts?
Well, I will say, just in terms of this stay that the Senate Republicans say that they're going to file with the U.S. Supreme Court, there's some precedent for how these have been going. One similar filing in South Carolina was successful. They got a stay and didn't have to redraw their maps immediately. You know, it's anybody's guess as to actually if these deadlines, these very tight deadlines that the court has set, will end up having to be, you know, kept by the legislature. But if that's the case, it's going to be a really difficult process for them. And we won't know exactly what's happening for at least a few days, if not more. So it's going to be a very hectic time in Harrisburg.
Thank you very much, Katie Meyer and WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Tim.
You might have heard the Philadelphia Eagles advance to the Super Bowl last night. 2 weeks from now, in Minneapolis, they'll meet a familiar foe. To set the scene, WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt takes us back to February 2005.
George W. Bush had just started his second term. Gas cost $1.90 a gallon. And the number one movie was Boogeyman, a horror flick about a man facing his childhood fears.
You okay?
It's just hard being back.
It takes a while.
The next 2 weeks, Eagles fans will face down their own demons from the past. Their names are Bill Belichick.
Let's spend a little more time focusing on our job and less time jawing and pushing them, okay?
And Tom Brady.
All right, zero slot out, 74, quick, D slant, on one, ready?
Belichick and Brady were the head coach and quarterback of the New England Patriots 13 years ago when they beat the Eagles 24-21. For their third Super Bowl title together. Injured Philly receiver Terrell Owens had a remarkable game. Starting quarterback Donovan McNabb wasn't as sharp.
Down the middle of the field, the pass is picked off by Harrison.
Like some unkillable monster from the past, Belichick and Brady are still New England's head coach and quarterback, and they are once again in the title game, seeking their sixth championship and second in a row. The Eagles, meanwhile, are simply trying to win their first Super Bowl title. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Not everyone is going to be able to go to Minnesota to see the Eagles beat the Patriots. Okay, we're hoping the Eagles beat the Patriots. And columnist Ronnie Polonesky had the ultimate idea. Open up the link, bring everybody in to watch the game on the big screen. The problem? It's not allowed. Ronnie Polonesky joins us here on Newsworks Tonight. Explain the concept and why it won't work.
The stadium seats 69,000 plus fans. They have beautiful jumbotron, whatever they're called, screens, these big high-def things.
Bigger than a billboard.
Huge. They're huge. And if you've ever been to the game, you just watch the screens the whole time. And so I thought, well, since no one is ever going to get to go to the Super Bowl, why not open up the link, televise the game on those screens, and we could get 69,000 fans in the stadium having a big watch party. I mean, people are going to bars anyway. So if you do that, you can open it up, and we could just all be together to watch this thing that will probably happen like as often as Halley's Comet comes around.
So being the good investigative journalist that you are,
yeah,
you looked into this.
I did.
What happened?
The NFL has a longstanding policy. They've repeated it so often that the guy sounded bored when he told me. He's like, he goes, yes, I know. We get this call all the time. Longstanding policy, no mass televised viewing at all because it interferes with the contracts they have with their broadcast partners. And they can't tally the Nielsen ratings of how many eyeballs are on those ads. And so then they don't know how to crunch the numbers so that they can charge the correct amount to the clients who are going to advertise. And so therefore, no, we can't have it ever. So I think that that's not right. I mean, Major League Baseball does it. The World Series was televised inside the Houston Astros stadium when they won the World Series because they were away. Mm-hmm. The NBA championships were televised in the very arena where they had played, where the team played. The same thing with the Stanley Cup playoffs and the game. And if you go online, or if you want, you could read my column. I've got embedded links to YouTube videos of those in-stadium watch parties, and they are a hoot. It just, I just think we would have such a ball.
Well, I mean, one of the watch parties wasn't necessarily a watch party, but last weekend,
right,
there was a great YouTube video out there of people at the Minnesota Timberwolves game watching that miraculous catch that put Minnesota into the championships against the Eagles. Makes sense. Not allowed. So you've gotten proactive here. You've set up a petition.
Right, I did. And I think the signatures have gone over 1,500, but I think we should just crank them way, way up there. I think there's a few things. One, I think it's a chance for the city to give people who have never been inside the link, who could never afford to go to a game,
true,
gives them a chance to go in there and see what they've been missing. And that link was built with $216 million,
yep,
dollars, right? And we'll never see it. The other thing, too, they could charge. And if you charge, you might even actually screen out some people who don't want to pay. They could charge, say, $20. And I did the math on this. Philadelphia, the Eagles Charitable Foundation, each year, when you look at their tax returns, their total contributions are about $1.2 million a year. This, if you did $20 per person, would raise more in one day, about $1.35 million, I think, for their charities than they get the entire year. So that's,
and let's not forget the concessions.
Okay. Another NFL insider, someone very familiar with the link, they said that the team and the link break even at every game on concessions and parking. So I said, geez, they're going to have to, you know, hire, you know, have all the staff comes in, you know, come in. And he goes, oh, they just always break even on that. So it's just one day. Come on. I mean, who knows when this is going to happen again, you know? So I think it could be a great opportunity for the city just to come together and have this great civic moment together. I think the fans are actually a whole lot better than the rest of the world gives us credit for.
Ronnie Polonesky, columnist, Philadelphia Inquirer, Daily News, and Philly.com. Thank you for joining us here on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks so much, and go Eagles.
There you go. And you can find that petition by searching for Super Bowl watch parties at change.org. 1,580 signed so far. SEPTA is the last major transit agency in North America to still use tokens. But starting today, the agency has stopped selling tokens at its stations. It's a big step forward in moving riders onto the new fare card system, SEPTA Key. But as Jim Sasso of Plan Philly reports, now that tokens are finally going away, riders are starting to feel nostalgic for the coins they used to curse.
SEPTA's finally pulling the plug on tokens. They were hard to find and easy to lose, and a source of provincial embarrassment whenever a visitor asked, wait, you guys still use tokens? And yet, instead of dancing on their mass grave, Philadelphians are suddenly full of fond remembrances for the infernal silver and copper-colored coins. Emma Tremble says she'll miss them.
One thing I particularly like about tokens is if you have no cash on you, and you're like searching through your purse, and you're like, got a token. So, you know, so it's like saves the day.
The token's imminent demise has spawned a mini industry of token-based arts and crafts. Anita Mastriani runs Tokens of Affection along with two of her oldest friends. The trio of Hallahan High grads turned SEPTA tokens into earrings and necklaces, which they name after different stops.
You know, it's funny to us because we just randomly assign the names. They don't really mean anything on that set of earrings, but people want their Tioga earrings. They want their Margaret Orthodox earrings because that's what they associate. You know, that's their stop. And that's really meaningful to people.
It's not uncommon for a city's transit agency to become a symbol of the city itself. In New York, they sell T-shirts that play on the MTA signs. There are songs about the Paris Metro.
Riding on the Metro.
And the T in Boston. And at SEPTA's gift shop? Yeah, that's right. SEPTA has a gift shop. You can buy all sorts of memorabilia. So, Mastriani says, it makes sense that people so deeply associate SEPTA and the token with Philadelphia.
You know, SEPTA is part of everybody's life if you live in Philadelphia. It's hard to avoid it.
And for many people, it means more than just a $2 bus fare. For Kate Rath, a SEPTA token became a memento she shares with a special someone.
After a first date, I gave my suitor a token so he could take the train home. A sentimental and hopeful man, he pocketed the token and chose to walk home instead that day. 2 years later, and that token sits in the home that he and I share together.
Jane Glenn took that kind of token sentimentality a step further.
In 1997, I got married on the SEPTA bus, and we used tokens in the fare box instead of rings on our fingers.
And why not? I mean, what are rings but tokens with a hole in them? Just the image of a token can become a totem for hometown pride. Friends Hannah Sassman and Val Soul got matching token tattoos. The shared ink commemorates the time they spent living together in West Philly. Sassman says she also met her husband on a SEPTA trolley.
One of the things that I always think about is tokens is something extraordinary, rare, and precious. Like the freedom to move around this beautiful city with this extraordinary public transit system that can take you from these quiet, leafy, historic suburbs all the way to like the center of historic Philadelphia. Like that's gorgeous.
And so tokens aren't just passes for getting around town. They've become passwords for Philadelphians seeking to prove their 215 authenticity. Of course, as symbolic and meaningful as tokens may be, most folks are ready to see them relegated to the slag heap of history. Glenn, who used tokens instead of rings, is ready to see them go, and for good reason.
Well, then 2009, we separated, so much for tokens.
The marriage didn't last, but Glenn's relationship with SEPTA is still going strong.
I've had my senior pass for a couple years, which is great. So better than tokens.
This may be the last stop for SEPTA tokens, but Philadelphia will ride on. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
Last week at this time, we urged listeners to look up at the sky to consider the phases of the moon. If you missed last Tuesday's new moon, no worries. Prepare to pick up this Wednesday. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller sat down with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, for some first quarter moon tips and suggestions.
All right, Derek, here we go again. First quarter, what's to note?
Well, we've come about 25% through the orbit of the moon around the Earth, and that motion has brought us to what we call first quarter, which shows up on Wednesday this week, the 24th. And here's some things that you can look for. You can already see them if you're looking tonight or tomorrow night. There's that line that separates the illuminated portion of the moon from the slightly darker region of the moon that we can see facing us. And that line really is like the sunrise line on the moon or the sunset line on the moon, depending where you are. The technical name is the terminator, and it's the line that separates the light half from the dark half. The really cool thing about the terminator is that it's a great location to look for the three-dimensional relief appearance of the surface of the moon. If you just look at the moon in full moon mode, it doesn't seem to have very much dimensionality. It appears flat, and that's because there are no shadows that provide any kind of contrast or hint as to elevation. At first quarter moon, it's the perfect time to actually see the depth of craters, the height of mountains, and other features on the surface because the shadows provide that context. So with a great pair of binoculars, you can see all kinds of great features, including this three-dimensional nature.
Of course, the craters are evidence of the pounding the moon took in the earlier days of the solar system. Any of that still going on?
Oh, in fact, there is plenty of that still going on, although the scale is greatly diminished. No longer do we see the very large objects crashing into the surface of the moon, but we do see some small objects, occasionally flashes on the surface that indicate that impacts are still taking place. And, you know, that's a really good thing because as we look at the surface of the moon, we see the craters. They indicate the amount of bombardment that has happened in this region of the solar system over time. So we should think of the moon, though, as having been a shield or a protector for Earth because what struck the moon didn't strike Earth.
Though the moon was a less than perfect protector.
Yes, less than perfect protector because some of that stuff has leaked through and we still see some of it today. Most obviously, in the form of meteors, those bright streaks that we see zipping through the sky, but they actually represent a very, very small proportion of that, which does fall down onto the surface. About 100 tons of space dust falls onto the surface of the Earth every day.
Sounds like a lot of dust.
Well, if you multiply it out, it certainly seems like a lot. Say 100 tons times 365 days a year, that's 36,500 tons of stuff. While that seems like a lot of dust, it really isn't very much at all. It's minuscule, almost insignificant in terms of the mass of the planet itself. So even though this has been going on for millions upon millions of years, we still haven't gained enough weight to change the Earth's orbit around the sun. And there's no real chance of us needing to worry about that before other kinds of things, dynamics, take hold of the Earth and do with it as they will.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.